Well, good morning. It's very nice to be here. I will just say a little bit about myself so you know who is speaking to you this morning. I am a part-time minister, a consulting minister, at a Unitarian church called Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church, and it is in Heartland, Wisconsin, which is just a half an hour to the west of Milwaukee. So I live in Madison, and so I commute there. I have office hours two or three times a week, and then I speak there twice a month. And then I'm available, of course, for weddings and funerals, memorial services, things like that. And this is my first year with them. I have been living in Sweden for the last several years. When I was 18, I was an exchange student. I was not on Rotary. I was with AFS. But that's when I was sent to Sweden the first time. And then 30 years later, I went back to Sweden. And I was able to get employment immediately. I taught English at comparative literature at a high school. And then I taught English at a college to help people who wanted to get their grades up to go to university be able to improve their English grades. And then I was asked to speak or to teach at a folkhögskola, which is for adult education. And I taught Swedish to immigrants and refugees from Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Eritrea, those countries. And then I moved to Madison, and I spoke at the Lake Country UU Church one fall, and then in the summer they invited me to come back and also just happened to mention they were looking for a minister, and so I said, I'd like to throw my hat into the ring. And so I did throw my hat into the ring, and I was fortunate enough to be the one that they hired to be their minister. And so this has been my first year with them, and they have now extended my contract for one more year. So it's very wonderful. I have taken this year to get to know all of the members of the congregation. They bought this building 3 years ago, and they were 50 adults and 35 children, and now they are 130 adults and 85 children. And most Unitarian churches look a little bit like this, not so many children and a majority of older people being in smaller Unitarian congregations because the wisdom lies there. But this congregation has about three people who are 70 and the rest are in their 50s or younger and lots of kids. So it's very, very unusual. It's really exciting to have that. You can see the future right in front of your eyes, and it's very exciting. Also, Waukesha County, which is where this church is considered, I found out, the most conservative county in the nation, both religiously and politically. So having the Unitarian Universalist Church there is truly a sanctuary when people are able to find that we exist. So that's a little bit about me. My talk today is entitled To Live Deliberately, because one of my favorite little bits in this book is actually this piece from Thoreau. It continues to reinvigorate me and to remind me why I need to get up every day. And so I just wanted to share a little bit about myself with you since you don't know anything about me. As a new speaker to this congregation, I thought it might be useful for you to know who I am from a religious perspective and what that religious perspective means to me as a minister. Even as a little girl, I sensed a calling to a religious life. The Hogan family across the street from us in Duluth were Catholic, and when I had a sleepover with Kathy, we would use sleeping bags in her living room floor. Kathy would always fall asleep before I did, and I would lie awake, my eyes drawn to the quiet golden light that shone over the face of Jesus on the narrow wall to the side of the fireplace. And below Jesus was the Lord's Prayer, and I would read and read and read those words, bringing them into my mind and into my mouth. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. I thought this was a very beautiful poem and that it made such good sense. And here's how I interpreted it in my mind. It was a prayer to God or to Jesus, or maybe it was really to Mary, beautiful Mary, whom I always loved. I always thought the Catholics had it right, worshiping a mother, instead of always focusing on the greatness of man. And this was in the 1960s, and my feminism, although I was young, was right there. Live life on earth as you imagine it must be in heaven. Well, that seemed like a good way to try to live life, in a beautiful and positive way, where everyone was nice to each other. Make sure that no one goes hungry. Well, that seemed like a good thing to wish for, too, making sure there was no poverty or hunger. Don't get upset if people walk on your property and hope that other people would be nice if I were to trespass on their property. I thought of our cabin up north and those no trespassing signs that I would ignore because I wanted some blueberries or wild strawberries, or I just wanted to rover to a particular small island and have a picnic and a swim. What harm was there in that? Forgive me for trespassing. Forgive me for this, as I would certainly forgive you. So that part of the prayer seemed very important to me, and it made great sense. I didn't know what temptation was, but I did understand what evil looked like because I had seen enough scary movies. And I definitely wanted to be delivered from any of those kinds of things. So I thought this was a really good thing to request of God. And then that last part, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever, amen. Well, that was just a great piece of rhythmic poetry, and I really loved saying it. This prayer was also sensible to me because I wanted to become a nun when I grew up. And even though my mother was Jewish, and we didn't go to church, and no one in my family believed in God, nor did I really felt drawn to becoming a nun, particularly one in France, since I loved their soft gray nun outfits instead of the severe black ones I saw around Duluth. That soft gray was so much friendlier looking, I thought. And I wanted to be in an order where they helped the poor and really made a difference in the world, where they didn't just talk about doing things, but where they really were out there doing what needed to be done to help alleviate the suffering of others. I wanted that. And to do it in a foreign language just added its appeal to me in my mind. It seemed like the very best way to live out life, to be a kind and caring person who helped others. I tried praying at night, like my friend Kathy did, but I just couldn't quite figure out who I was actually praying to, since it seemed to me that it was just like wishing for something on your birthday when you blew out candles. Oh, I wished that when I grew up I would be someone who did good things in the world and who cared about others, could really, really try to end suffering. And then I would picture not God, but me, blowing out all those candles and wanting that wish to come true. I would then say amen and climb into bed, hopeful that the message had been received wherever it was off to. I was also very open to Jesus sitting on the edge of my bed, like I heard he did so often for people who were in prison who had never believed in him before. And then one night there he would be, and now they believed. So many of my friends were either Catholic or some kind of Christian that Jesus was with us in our conversations as much as any other topic. I felt that there really was a Jesus, and if he really did exist still, that as much as I thought it would be actually kind of scary to have him appear at the foot of my bed, I would be open to that happening. If it was real, let him appear. I wanted to see him, just like my friends said that they did. Well, he never did appear for me, not once. Nor did I ever hear the voice of God, although I really, really listened for it for years. I just thought it was all such a very beautiful concept, and I wanted to believe in those things. And then my brother died of cancer when he was 19 years old, and my best friend told me that God had killed my brother because our family didn't believe in God. And at the very moment that she said this, I stopped looking. Would God really have punished my brother with suffering cancer because our family didn't believe in him? That seems so small-minded and cruel. How could anyone worship something like that? And how was that loving or kind or something good to pray to? It made no sense to me, and I turned my back on God's possible existence. But my desire for the religious life never waned. I was raised Unitarian in the way of most Unitarians. That is, we never went to church. My mother had been raised Jewish and my father raised Congregationalist. They weren't joiners, but raised us children with a high ethical core and a strong moral compass. And one day when I was about 35, a friend of mine invited me to go to a Unitarian Universalist church in Minneapolis. And although I had been to many churches during my lifetime, for some reason I had never been to a Unitarian Universalist church. And that first experience was memorable for me. The service was remarkable in that the Bible was not used, but there was instead a reading from Mark Twain's Letters from Earth. There was no organ, but a small chamber orchestra playing some gorgeous classical music. The hymns had words I could actually say, rather than just focusing on the melody and not paying attention to the usual Jesus and salvation and God language I was used to singing in the other churches I would attend. The sermon was called an address, and it was about things that mattered to me, said in perfectly sensible, real language that had real meaning. I was transfixed. After the service, just like every other UU, I gathered up every single solitary brochure that was on the stand in the lobby. What UUs say about Jesus, what UUs say about the Bible, what UUs believe. I hoped that no one would talk to me, and I slipped out as fast as I could. And I went home, and I read, and I read, and I read. Just like I had the Lord's Prayer so long ago, and I committed to memory the seven purposes and principles of our tradition. This was it. I had finally found my religious home. It had all made sense to me with no translations necessary, and it was who I was. It was who I had always been. Fortunately, the church I had gone to that day was looking for a part-time religious education person, so I applied and was hired within days. And I became good friends with a student minister there who was a seminary student in Chicago but doing her internship in Minneapolis. I was the mother of three young children, and so there was no way I could just pack up and go to Chicago or Boston or California to study to be a Unitarian minister at those Unitarian seminaries. I felt that once more I was so close to my dream of being in a religious life, and that once again it was not going to happen. And then this young minister told me about the UCC seminary, United Church of Christ Seminary, that is right on the outskirts of the Twin Cities, and how historically the Unitarians used to be part of the Congregational Church, and so maybe I could contact the seminary and see if I could study there. I did, and they said yes, and my long journey toward becoming a Unitarian Universalist minister began. I was finally on the path of my calling. But it was not a path paved with jewels. My best friend and sister-in-law, who was a born-again Christian, upon hearing that I was going to study to become a UU minister, told me she could no longer be my friend. We had raised our children together, and we were inseparable. We had, of course, had many theological discussions, and she was always trying to guide me toward Jesus and praying for me. And seriously, I have so many people praying for me. I've written a sermon called A Shoe-In to Heaven. I'm very grateful for this little element. But nevertheless, we loved each other. We were the same person. And so this sudden break was and is one of the most painful parts of my life. That was 20 years ago, and to this day she cannot be my friend because I went public with my UU thoughts when I became a minister. It was one thing, she told me, to be privately thinking the way that I did, but to speak from a pulpit was now a dangerous thing, a threat to Christianity and therefore a threat to the world. When I was a hospital chaplain, I was often requested by patients or by nursing staff to be the chaplain they wished to have in their room or on their unit. My supervisor wrote a review of me once to put in a file, noting that I was requested more than the other chaplains and that he found this quite distressing. Because there is no way that you are able to console and comfort these patients since you do not believe in God. It's absolutely not possible. And yet, apparently, it was possible. Does a person have to believe in God in order to be decent, and kind, caring, compassionate, and empathetic? I asked. And his answer was yes. For without God, he maintained, a human is unable to have a morality, unable to determine an ethical path. When I countered my supervisor, saying that he must be mistaken about this, since I was actually able to do all of those things without a belief in God, he leaned over his desk, his face darkened and strained, and he yelled, "So, you think you are God?" And then I leaned forward, and I said, "Yes." We are all the children of God, created in God's image. Isn't this so? Isn't that what Christianity says? If I am in God's image, would I not be like God with his love and compassion and moral and ethical compass, leading my heart in the right way? Isn't that what we humans are to strive toward? He ordered me out of his office and put me on review. When I was the consulting minister for the River Falls congregation, I was a part of the local area ministerial association, and as such was asked to participate in their annual ecumenical Thanksgiving Day service. It was to be held in the Catholic Church, and I was to be the speaker for the service. The day before the service, we had our usual ministerial meeting, and before the meeting came to a close, the minister leading that day asked us all to stay for a minute because he wanted to talk about something that had come up. The thing that had come up was that some of the ministers had been telling their congregants to boycott the ecumenical service because I would be taking away their Christianity. I was stunned, but this was true. There was going to be a boycott on Thanksgiving. They had great fear. Because I didn't believe in God or believe that Jesus was the Son of God, that whatever it was I was going to be speaking about, which they hadn't even asked me to share, that I would somehow be a threat to these people who were listening to me. I spoke to their fear that they thought that I would be saying anything that would be disrespectful to the beliefs of those who would be coming to that surface, to that service. I explained Unitarian Universalism to them and our drawing from world religions and our respect for other ways of being in the world. And then I spoke to the fact that they themselves, as ministers, must be filled with such arrogance, with such a sense of power, to think that it is the minister who gives and who can take away a person's beliefs, rather than believing, as Unitarian Universalists do, that each person comes to their own way of believing for themselves. The Thanksgiving Day service happened, and the place was filled, and many people came up to me afterwards who were members of those other churches and told me that they hadn't felt threatened by at all by what I had said, and that they actually felt it was a religious service even without the God language, and that they would never have believed that to be possible if they hadn't come there themselves, and that maybe having a UU church in town was okay. What I didn't understand then, but saw quickly thereafter, was that UUs in general were suspect, and that humanists in particular were seen as something bad. The word humanist was often stated and underscored with the words cold, intellectual, no heart. And the word spirituality was seen as the preferable one to use, implying something richer and deeper than anything humanism could possibly contribute or create. But what does that word spirituality mean, anyway? It's so nebulous and so hard to describe or pinpoint, especially without the traditional theological trappings to define it. I've thought a great deal about this over all these years, and I believe it means responding to something that speaks to your heart, that stirs you to your core, that inspires you to attend to the truth that rests within you, that rests within all of us. We all have this aha experience at some point or another in our lives, whether we are humanist, agnostic, atheist, Christian, Jew, Buddhist, Muslim. What we experience as spiritual may be different for each of us, be it religion or music or poetry or the sparkling stars in the heavens that shine over our heads in great bursts of light. Our response to that thing which speaks to our deepest sense of being is a spiritual one, and it is a human one. It is as strong a guiding force for good in the world as any I can think of. And as you use of whatever ilk we may be, it is ours, as well as those of other faith traditions. As Unitarian Universalists, we must remember to focus on what we have in common, not what among us is different. In this religion, we have the chance to strengthen the bonds between people because we come from a religion that wants to speak the truth about life and death, about love and hate, about happiness and despair, without turning our faces away from the difficulties that lie before us. In this religion, we are reminded that when one person suffers, we all suffer. When one person goes without food, shelter, or water, we all go without. When one person cannot take care of themselves or their families, we are all equally burdened and suffering. Our question to ourselves is not when will things improve, but how can we, as a religious institution, affect the changes necessary to ensure that the rights of all people are attended to? Our question to ourselves is how can we come together under one roof, under one sky, under one umbrella of faith, a faith that encourages and challenges us to be the best that we can be, humans in this world, and do whatever it is we must do to ensure that everyone's basic needs are being met. Our issues are humanitarian issues. Our goal is for the betterment of the world. Our hopes and dreams are those which provide the best life for each and every person, regardless of age and gender, sexual orientation, or belief. We have a strong voice and a strong heart to offer the world, and our UU faith is the perfect faith within which to get things done. Because a group of people, a presence in the community, a place of religion that is recognizable to the masses is the best jumping-off point for real change to take place. Through this religion of my upbringing, I am reminded to live deliberately and to help create positive change in the world. What do your religious upbringings inspire you to do? As Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of people can bring about change, for indeed it is the only thing that can." Thank you.